Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Rule number one of capitalism, gang, goes like this. Never, ever expect markets to make sense. Oil is where we start today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be with us on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 16th of February today, and I, for one, wish the global oil market would, once and for all, make up its mind. There's too much supply. Supply is too tight. Prices are too high. Oil is too cheap. Exhibit A today is this. After a long stretch of pumping as much as they want for as long as they want, four major oil-producing countries now say they are going to freeze production to January's levels if other countries go along, hoping, perhaps, one assumes, guesses, to impose a bottom on the very slippery price of crude. And yet, the price of oil at the close today in New York, down, still below $30 a barrel because, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, too many other places want to keep on pumping.
Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Qatar have agreed to limit oil production to January levels. That is a really big deal, said no one.
Agreeing to limit it to January is not a big feat.
Fariborz Gadar is a professor at Penn State. First, January production was record-breaking in some countries, and analysts say these countries had no plans to increase production beyond that to begin with. Second, two big players have zero desire to abide by this agreement.
I doubt if Iran is going to agree to any cutback because they've been under sanctions for so long, and this is now their chance to increase production. The Iraqis also need the money desperately. The war has cost enormous damage to everything.
Even without Iraq and Iran, oil producers have a problem. Michael Levy is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Saudi leaders are worried that if they cut production to prop up prices, more U.S. production and production from other countries will come onto the market. And ultimately, the price will not be all that changed, but Saudi Arabia will just be selling less oil.
They're basically just giving away market share and not getting a better price. That goes for most big producers. Robert Johnston, CEO of Eurasia Group, says in a best-case scenario,
one more bullish view on this would be that this is the first step towards a larger agreement that would have more of an impact on supply-demand balances.
But he adds,
our view is probably that this is less than it appears.
So don't hold your breath for across-the-board production cuts anytime soon. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
24.9 million people tuned into the Grammys last night, off from last year and the lowest numbers that broadcast has done since 2009. CBS did say that its live stream of the Grammys, though, registered a record audience. You, the would-be user, might have had a sort of a technical difficulties kind of night. Twitter lit up last night with complaints from frustrated fans. And this isn't just an issue with award shows. All kinds of must-see TV, sporting events, political debates, all of them have had streaming problems of late because, wait, why is it so hard to live stream events anyway? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is on that one.
Picture a busy superhighway. Now imagine that highway is the internet. It can get clogged, especially during rush hour, say when everyone's trying to live stream a live event at the same time.
Too many cars on the road.
That's Greg Ireland, an analyst covering multi-screen video at IDC. He says problems can start immediately as the content provider evaluates you.
A jam at the toll booth. It's making sure you've collected your ticket, that you're authorized to be on the system.
There could be legal roadblocks. For example, CBS apparently didn't have live stream revenue sharing agreements with all of its affiliates. Then there's the issue of which exit your live stream takes. Adam Preset is principal research analyst at Gartner.
You might want to view the stream. Your neighbor might want to view the stream. And it makes a lot more sense to have a local copy of that stream very close to you.
And that local road might be clogged. Then finally, when the live stream gets to your house, it may not be able to get in because everybody in the neighborhood is on the internet. Jeff Baumgartner is technology editor at Multichannel News.
You know, you have the bandwidth just heading into the home. I think it's been a little bit of a challenge to kind of scale everything together.
Baumgartner says these huge public spectacles can overtax the internet's infrastructure from the source all the way to the device you hold in your hand. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, so over to healthcare now. There is a line of thinking in healthcare these days that goes something like this. To get more bang for the medical buck, we need to know how much things really cost. Transparency is the buzzword. And it gets us to a line item in the president's budget that dropped last week that drug makers have to share publicly what they're spending on R&D, research and development. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains that is a spotlight the pharmaceutical industry is eager to get out of.
It's hard to hate on transparency. That's kind of like hating on baseball, apple pie, or Taylor Swift. But when it comes to getting a better handle on drug makers' R&D costs, industry trade group Pharma has got no love.
Transparency for what?
That's Pharma spokesperson Priscilla Vanderveer.
And what we've seen in some states and in some areas, and including in the budget, is potential price controls. And if that's what we're going towards, then of course we fundamentally disagree.
As drug costs keep rising, it's clear there's a growing chorus to rein that in. But Ken Caton with Tufts says looking at R&D costs is looking at the wrong thing.
All of these transparency initiatives are based on the premise that if we know how much you spent to develop this product, we'll have a better idea how much you should charge for that product. And that's just not the way it works.
Caton says when it comes to setting a price for a drug that costs $20 or $90,000, there are three key factors. Are there competitors? What are people willing to pay? And what's the value? Dr. Ron Cohen, head of Acorda Therapeutics, says figuring out value and how to reward it is the way forward.
We are being paid for the actual outcomes for the patients who take our medications. Those are the sorts of things that we are signing up for and need to continue to sign up for.
So if a drug company releases a new blockbuster and it goes, the company doesn't get paid much. If the manufacturer cures Alzheimer's, then the drug maker gets paid a premium. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Oil, as I said, down. Stocks were up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There have been some updates of late to the way that healthcare providers handle your medical records, specifically the way doctors and hospitals act when you want a copy of your own records. The government's been getting lots of complaints. Doctors weren't turning them over or taking forever to do it. And lots of us are familiar with having one doctor send your records over to another one for a referral. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now from Washington, more and more people want a copy of their records for themselves, and that can be a huge hassle.
Diana Gordon lives in a nice house on a hill in the D.C. suburb of Arlington, Virginia. But she's been to doctors in Florida, Michigan, Maryland, and Virginia for major nerve issues.
I had to stop working 6 years ago, go on disability, chronic pain.
While we're talking, she's constantly moving, stretching and fidgeting to distract herself from the pain. The 53-year-old even had brain surgery in New York last year, trying to ease the suffering. But every doctor wants to know what the others did. And for that, Gordon needs her records.
You know, there were holes here, and we'd be calling doctor's offices and trying to get records, getting sort of, I don't know where that file is, or can't get that.
She and her husband, both lawyers, paid thousands for help gathering the documents. Devin McGraw works with the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Health and Human Services.
It is hard for patients to get these records today. It shouldn't be.
The department recently clarified a part of the privacy rules about patient access. If you ask for your records, you're supposed to get them back within 30 days. And McGraw says you can't be required to go pick them up. They can be mailed or emailed.
But it's really going to make a difference when the healthcare providers stop sort of seeing this as a regulatory mandate and start seeing it as this is part of healthcare.
The information, even though it's yours, isn't free. My doctor's office wanted to charge me 76 cents a page for my records. When you've been to as many doctors as Gordon, those pages can add up quickly.
This is stack number one.
She's holding a folder stuffed with documents a couple inches thick.
And there's another stack about twice as big downstairs. But, there's a whole nother.
And even that's not all her records. Patients aren't the only ones paying. John Larson is an OBGYN affiliated with George Washington University.
It's a real cost of doing business.
Doctors and hospitals have to hire people to take those requests, then retrieve, print, and mail them. Dr. Larson has worked with other doctors in the D.C. area, including some from smaller practices.
They feel a great deal of stress about having to have their limited office staff take on additional unfunded mandates. And so they feel the pressure.
But he's still supportive of patients keeping copies of their medical records. He says the more information people have, the more engaged they can be with their care. Plus, sharing the records is easier than it used to be. Steve Parenti studies health finance at the University of Minnesota.
It's probably going to be a substantial cost, but it should be less of a cost than it would have been, say, 10 years ago, now that more hospitals and physicians are putting their records out electronically.
But still sending them to patients on paper via snail mail. Parenti says without better technology, it will continue to be expensive for providers and patients.
That's great. Hi. Are you all done? Are you all done?
For Diana Gordon, playing with her Cocker Spaniel despite her chronic pain, it's more than that. She dreads gathering documents for her next appointment.
It makes it exhausting to think about going to see somebody. That causes pain.
The Department of Health and Human Services says it's working on more guidelines that are supposed to make the process easier. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Every day, somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people land in Greece, many of them, if not all of them, refugees from the war in Syria. But not all Syrian refugees head to Europe. Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan host millions more Syrians than Europe does. So the BBC's Venetia Rainey reports from Beirut now about how the war in Syria is spilling over into the Lebanese economy.
It was 6 p.m. on a mild November evening when two ISIS suicide bombers struck a busy shopping street in South Beirut, killing more than 40 and wounding hundreds. In a testament to Lebanese resilience, within a week the diverse neighborhood of Bourg Abarajne was back to normal. Only now the air was filled with the sounds of reconstruction and defiant political chants. In most places, suicide bombings would be bad for business. But in a shop near the blast site selling gleaming piles of fake designer goods, a clerk called Ali insisted the attack hadn't made a difference to sales.
We have experienced these kind of tragedies before. Life is going to go on. We're not going to let this stop us at all. I assure you, business was back to normal the very next day after the bombing.
Not everyone agrees with this assessment. Hassan owns a clothes shop right by where one of the attackers blew himself up, and the building sustained heavy damage. He estimated the cost at $50,000. I spoke to him in the immediate aftermath of the attack, when he said there were much fewer people out shopping than usual.
I have a big problem now. I have a big company here, but after the bombing, business just went dead. As you see, I have 15 employees here, and they're all sitting around doing nothing because we have no customers. It's a big loss for me.
Overwhelmingly, however, the official version of events is one of business as usual. Bozhabarazhny mayor, Zuher Jalou, ordered municipality staff to work non-stop to clear away the bombing debris, everything from bits of cars to mangled iron shop shutters. The street was a mess. He estimated the damage at $600,000. But within 24 hours, it was completely reopened.
The reason we cleared everything away so fast is to send a message to the people behind the bombing. We love life, and we are not going to let them change our ways.
Sadly, this can-do attitude is sorely missing at a governmental level, as evidenced by political infighting that has left the country without a president for a year and a half.
The Syrian crisis has affected a lot the Lebanese economy, and today the cost of the Syrian crisis on the economy, on the Lebanese economy, is around $1.5 to $2 billion per year.
That's Walid Abu Sleiman, an economic analyst and the founder and CEO of financial services company Axis Capital. So while on a microeconomic level, Beirut has shown itself highly resilient to events such as bombings over the past few years, on a macro level, things are more complicated, not least because of the five-year war ravaging Lebanon's neighbor, Syria.
The BBC's Venetia Rainey in Beirut for us. Coming up.
I've rarely seen such box office surprises in my career, and that's saying a lot because I've been covering box office for about 10 years.
Deadpool slays the weekend box office, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 222 points today, 1.4%, ended at 16,196. The NASDAQ up 98 points, about 2.25%, finished at 4,435. The S&P 500 gained 30 points, 1.6%. 1895 there. First, a big corporate deal. Apollo Global Management is buying ADT Corporation, the home alarm company, valuing it at $7 billion. Making the leap from burglar alarms to smart homes is the play there. Apollo up 5%. ADT shares, they were on fire. Boom, boom, up 47%. People stay healthy. Hospitals get sick. Community health systems, that's a hospital chain, surprised analysts with a loss for the quarter and put the blame on patients, or that is a lack thereof. Fewer emergency room visits than last year. Fewer cases of the flu. You know the drill. Community health down 22%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
And now, a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment. The automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You want a business opportunity? Here's one. Space. Companies like SpaceX and Virgin Galactic and Blue Ocean as well, they're all leading the way. But some rural areas are angling for a slice of the $300 billion-plus global space industry. From WABE in Atlanta, Molly Samuel reports on Georgia's bid for its own private spaceport.
Back in December, hundreds of people turned out for a meeting about a commercial spaceport that Camden County hopes to build near the Atlantic coast. The vast majority of people were excited about the idea, like Bob Shepard.
I think it would be tremendous for not only the county in whole, but the other businesses it will attract.
Camden County is in the far southeastern corner of the state, largely rural. Its biggest employer is a naval base. Shepard's son, Thomas, who's 13 and wore his Boy Scout uniform, said he imagines one day he might work there, but for now he's looking forward to a launch.
I would like to see it go off in the backyard and I'll learn more stuff about the rocket.
The lead booster for Spaceport Camden is Steve Howard, who's also the county administrator. He brought me to peek through the fence at the place where the facility would go. From the road, there's not much to see. It's thousands of acres of very flat Georgia coastland. There's grass, trees, and a lot of gnats. But Howard's got a vision of rockets blasting off from this spot.
Camden County really went from a mill town to a military town, and I think we have an opportunity to really do something great here.
There are 8 commercial spaceports up and running in the country. This is one of several more that are proposed. Micah Walter Range is with the Space Foundation, a nonprofit that advocates for the space industry.
And small satellites are a rapidly growing area of the industry.
He says the current rush to build spaceports is in response to that expanding demand for satellites. Companies want to get their GPS and phone and video satellites into orbit. But Walter Range says whether the demand for satellite launches will keep expanding enough to sustain all the new spaceports that could open is still up in the air.
I think a lot of the demand for spaceports is somewhat speculative.
One's already in financial trouble. Spaceport America in New Mexico has failed to bring in the revenue it expected. It's now asking for millions of dollars from the state. The key is to not just build a spaceport, but to build an entire space industry, encouraging new startups and attracting existing companies. That's what Bobby Braun says. He's an aerospace professor at Georgia Tech. And he says if a Georgia space coast is hard to imagine in a rural corner of the state, just look a few hours south to Cape Canaveral.
Kennedy Space Center was not always the Kennedy Space Center. It used to be largely coastal swampland.
Now it's got not just rockets, but tourists and industry, too. That's likely a transformation places in Texas, Alabama, Colorado, Hawaii, and other states are all imagining as they gun for their own private spaceports. There is some opposition to the Georgia proposal. Megan DeRosiers is the head of a local environmental organization called 100 Miles.
There's a whole bunch of questions that we have, and, you know, they're both related to the human impact and the public health and public safety risk, as well as the environmental impacts and risks.
For instance, what happens if there's a crash? What will the effect be on a nearby river and marshes? What will this mean for nearby homeowners? But local booster Steve Howard is not deterred. He says he dreams of a highway sign greeting people driving into the state.
Wouldn't that be a great thing for Georgia if it said, "Welcome to Georgia Space Coast"?
Pending approval from the Federal Aviation Administration, that could be a reality in 5 years. In Camden County, Georgia, I'm Molly Samuel for Marketplace.
All right, serious question here. Who thought Zoolander 2 was a good idea? Anyway, the box office champion this weekend going away was Deadpool, starring Ryan Reynolds, which has taken in $150 million so far. The movie took more than 10 years to make and is most definitely not an audience-friendly PG-13 either. Pamela McClintock covers Hollywood and the box office in particular for The Hollywood Reporter. Pamela, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Why? How? Where did this film come from? How did it do so well?
That is a very good question. I've rarely seen such box office surprises in my career, and that's saying a lot because I've been covering box office for about 10 years.
Basically triple the budget basically in 3 days.
Right. Beginning Friday, the numbers just kept going up and up and up. And, you know, I think it's especially a surprise because it's an R-rated film and a very R-rated film at that.
Much has been written about Ryan Reynolds and how he stuck with this project and, you know, 10 years and it was his baby and all this. I wonder, though, how much credit Fox, the studio, gets for having had the gumption, I suppose, to go with that hard R.
I think they deserve a lot of credit for having the courage to do it. And it is, you know, it's their biggest opening in history, which is sort of an incredible stat.
There was also, though, this small matter of a couple of years ago, the film, and I'm doing air quotes here, parts of the film leaking online and that contributing to the virality and the buzz and the people started looking forward to this thing. And now finally it's here. And heck yeah, we're going to spend $15 to go see it.
You know, whoever leaked that footage, it was probably a combination of people on the filmmaking team and maybe somebody at the studio, but it really worked.
Yeah, brilliant, right? In hindsight.
Very brilliant. Every piece of content was intended to go viral, and it did.
Thing is, you can't control virality, right? I mean, sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't.
I mean, I think every piece of content had different goals. The first look piece of material that was released was Deadpool sort of mocking the famous Burt Reynolds Playboy centerfold. Mm-hmm. And that piece was really aimed at the fans to let them know what the costume looked like. And they came back saying the costume is great.
Also, though, I mean, they, so they had the fans, right, this week. Right. And they had the young males that you would expect a hard-R demographic to get. But it's not like you can do $150 million at the box office without getting people outside the target demographic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at this level, you're really getting everybody. But it is interesting to note that fanboys did turn out in huge force. And that's a demo that's been very hard to get in the last few years at the multiplex.
How long until we see, you know, not a Deadpool knockoff, but other studios saying, oh, yeah, hard R hero superhero movies?
You know, already people, sort of comic book experts, are saying to me, saying, look, it's not about the R, it's about staying true to the character. And in this case, Deadpool is a very R-rated character.
And that was the thing about Ryan Reynolds, right? I mean, he did it in X-Men Wolverines. He wasn't happy with how it was portrayed, and he wanted to just have it and do it his way.
Right. And that was sort of the reasoning behind sticking with it until the studio said yes to his vision.
Is this, and I'm a Ryan Reynolds fan. I like his, you know, I like to see him on the screen. Is this his redemption now after Green Lantern and RIPD and the other not so great things he's done?
Well, everybody's saying that. I mean, people, as I'm sure you've seen, are saying that this is doing for him what Iron Man did for Robert Downey Jr.
Hmm.
You know, sort of pushes him into a whole other level of stardom.
Pamela McClintock, she's a senior film writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Pamela, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, I'm just going to give it to you. You do with it what you will, all right? Americans, we learned today, spent more on legal marijuana last year than we did on junk food. The numbers come from ArcView Market Research and New Frontier Data. They are market research groups from the marijuana industry, so grain of salt and all that. Specifically, pot sales topped the sale of Doritos, Cheetos, and Funyuns combined. So, you know, dude. All righty, we got to go. Whiz-bang day to the upside on Wall Street today. The Dow, 222 points higher, about 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 98 points, 2.25% there. The S&P 500 gained 30 points, about 1.6%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, bud.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.